Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome acclaimed author Kent Nelson to our store. He'll be reading from his newest collection of short stories, The Spirit Bird, which was selected by esteemed author David Gutterson as the 2014 winner of the Drew Hines Literature Prize. It's one of our nation's most prestigious prizes for short fiction. Gutterson describes the collection as the work of an author whose passionate immersion in life is evident on every page. A Colorado native, Nelson has a passion for life indeed. He's lived all over the world and has held a stunning array of jobs, from hired hand on an alfalfa ranch in South Dakota, to dishwasher in Switzerland, to squash coach at Exeter, and staff writer for a tow truck magazine in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Currently, he's a college professor, an avid bird watcher, and a high-altitude marathon runner. He makes his home in Ouray, Colorado, and he said that for him, writing stories is about exploration and discovery. Please join me in welcoming Kent Nelson to the Tattered Cover Bookstore.
Thank you for being here. Writing, as you probably all know, is spending a lot of time by yourself in a small room. And I appreciate the support of a lot of people. My sister is here tonight. My partner, Judy Scheig, who has been a great support for the over many years. Friends Barb and Scotty Scott are here. Mia and Ronco, thank you for being here. Larry Dunning, who is a writer himself, published several books. Stand up, Larry. So thank you again for being here. I appreciate it. I thought I would read a story from the middle of the book called The Man at Quito Baquito. The cirrus are shrinking but still high, still white, high above the desert. The thicket darkens. The sun has fallen through the leaves of the single cottonwood at the pond, and the water is blue-gray and rose from the reflection of the sky. Near the slough, the air is muggy, but the quiet is what makes me uneasy. As Ellen and I follow the animal path around the water, I'm conscious of the pall that rises from the silence. A towhee scratching among dead leaves is the only sound. We're 20 miles from paved road, 30 from Lukeville, though from where we are, we can see the Mexican border. The treeless, rocky sierra, which from Lukeville seems so smooth in the distance, is forbidding now, jagged, serrated, holding long into the evening, the blank heat of the day. So long as it is level, we hold hands. But when we climb away from the pond, the trail peters out and we separate to choose our own paths through the rocks and saguaros and tangled mesquite. Each of us knows the place from years before, the ledge where flowing water has polished a smooth granite slab. I lag behind, carrying the cooler, thinking of the food and cold beer. My maroon and white truck, parked a quarter mile from the pond, recedes as we climb, and once above the thicket, the Abra Plain stretches out toward the border. I scan the brush and the aprons of the bajadas for animals. Coyotes, fox, badgers, deer, sometimes a javelina drink from this spring at Quito Baquito, but now nothing moves. Ellen, home for a visit, she says, though Lukeville was never home to her. Her father had once been the head of the local customs and immigration office, and she had merely passed time there during 2 years of high school. Her first night back, lying together in bed in the room above the store, she told me how it had been for her. You were quiet, she said. That's why I cared for you. And not for lack of choice, I asked. I've always thought of you, she said, turning toward me. She kissed me as though to prove what she said was true. And I of you. She eased away and propped her weight on her elbow. I listened to the insects droning in the darkness. What do you do here? She asked. I read. And work. Yes, I work. What are you waiting for? I shook my head, not understanding her question. You must be waiting for something. Everyone is waiting. I waited to get married, then I waited for the divorce. I waited to move from El Paso when my father was there. I waited to see you. I smiled and felt the smile linger at the corner of my mouth. I've only run the store, I said. Oh, yes, she said, the store. I'd been raised in the store. Lukeville was a border crossing, a town of 300, a place of transition. My mother spent her years remembering what travelers needed when the seasons changed, what they would have forgotten when they went to Mexico. The store stocked cans of food, dry goods, flashlights, gloves, tire repair kits, drinking water, medical supplies, shoes, hardware. We catered, too, to the townspeople, and my father died behind the counter measuring out for Pepe Sanchez's aunt a pound of coffee, which, when he fell, spilled across his body like dried blood. They traded off the hours, my mother and father, then my mother and I, until she died, too. What's wrong with the store? I asked. Ellen and I made love fiercely at first, then gently, as we had long ago, and she slept with her head on my shoulder and her bare leg across mine. But I woke early in the heat, thinking, staring at the broken fan on the ceiling. There were flies, thrashers, singing beyond the open window, and trucks just crossed from Mexico, probing the incline on the outskirts of town. A warm wind flows from the mountains, and I pause and watch a red-tailed hawk on a thermal. The bird tilts its wings slightly or spreads its tail, but these are the only movements it needs to keep astride the invisible currents of air. Ellen is far ahead of me, already nearing the ledge. Her white blouse stands out against the rocks and the gray-green mesquite on the hill behind her. She weaves behind a giant organ pipe, then reappears, jeans, white blouse, blonde hair loose. We've dispensed with the past. She's told me about the breakup of her marriage, about her cars and clothes, houses, pets, travels to Dallas, Denver, and Santa Fe. Her husband had an affair. She discovered it after the divorce, and the bitterness had not been exorcised. She spent a time drinking, then stopped. Now she wants to move forward again. She feels she is young enough to resurrect her life. You too, she said one night at dinner. So it's religious. I don't know. I've never prayed for the forgiveness of sins, a sin in itself. What sins had I committed with you? Was I to ask forgiveness for that? It wasn't love that was wrong, but later the absence of love. I stopped to rest and put down the cooler. March and still hot, even in the evening. The land absorbs the sun and keeps the heat. I wonder whether the sun could erode these rocky hills, whether the particles of light, like tiny grains the size of atoms, could in eons without rain break apart the rugged ridges of the Ajo and Puerto Blanco. Water and wind, the gently sloping bajada spiked with organ pipes and saguaros are the remains of mountains already washed from higher up. And the sand in the gullies is carried down by the winter rains. But if it never rained, could not the sun wear away the hills, just as it rots the leaves of creosote and palo verde, once their waxy leaves have lost their moisture, just as it now bleaches the bones of the dead? The hawk breaks from its still flight and wheels backward in midair toward the desert to the south. I open the cooler and take out fruit, ham, hard-boiled eggs, mayonnaise to find a beer in the melting ice at the bottom. I snap open the beer and drink. From my new angle on the hill, the reflection of the pond has changed to a darker blue, the color of the higher sky. The single cottonwood has shifted too, and the pond is quiet, the birds still in cover. I can't see anything in the impenetrable brush. Ellen pulls herself over the last few yards on hands and knees and gains the ledge. She stands against the black pockets of the ridge where the shards of pink light remain and waves to me. Hey, you, she calls. She unbuttons her blouse, rocks her hips from side to side, and holds the corners of the blouse at her waist so it flaps like white wings. I smile at her brazenness, knowing what she asks is so simple. I'm sweating when I reach the ledge, and I put the cooler down and catch my breath. The Quito Baquito hills are in blue shade, and the distant Ajos are pink-orange and black with the ascending line of the earth's shadow. The cirrus have dissipated, and soon only the moon that rises over the mountains will be in the light of the sun. I take off my shirt and sit down and take off my boots. The smooth stone is still warm to the touch. Ellen edges closer. What would you like? She asks. I don't answer. This. She touches me as though she wants me to understand she's the same as before, the same as she'll always be. She kisses me, then moves away to slip off her jeans and the blouse which flutters at her shoulders. She stands for a moment in profile, her face bearing into the warm breeze, her hair clear of her face. Against the darkening rock, her body shines. Then beneath us, a rock dislodges and clatters down the hillside. I sit up quickly and pull Ellen beside me. There's no one, she says. Quiet. I tighten my grip on her arm, lean forward. Three deer, two does and a buck, pick their way down the rocky slope toward the spring. Another stone rolls, snaps on rocks and brush, and bounces to the bottom of the draw. Do they know we're here? Ellen whispers. No, the wind is wrong. But the buck stops. The does browse the thin grass on the hillside, but the buck's ears are upright, and he gazes toward the dark slough below. Maybe a coyote, Ellen says. I shake my head. If it were a coyote, the birds would still sing. Ellen looks over the edge. You think someone's there. The buck snorts, still staring at the swarthy tangle of brush beside the pond, and I follow his gaze. It is still light enough to make out shapes in the open, the bulk of a saguaro, the thin spires of an organ pipe, the blue-gray light of the pond. There, Ellen says, as though I haven't seen. A solitary figure emerges from the thicket. He is real thin, bald, dressed in a ragged sweater and dark pants. A ridge of black hair curls above his ears. He's intent on some object, though his body hides it. He bends low to the ground. Ellen retreats from the edge of the rock and pulls on her blouse. You think he's been watching? She asks. As if hearing Ellen's voice, the man turns toward us. Is he Mexican? She asks. Maybe he's come across the border. Maybe, I say, but he doesn't look Mexican. Ellen lies down on the rock and slides into her jeans, then stands and turns her back to snap them and to button her blouse. Maybe he's escaped, she says. Maybe he's wanted. The buck snorts again and jumps away, leading the does into the draw. The deer crack more rocks as they spring across the scree, but sensing no pursuit, they slow again, and the buck stops to test the air. The man lays a bedroll on the ground, puts something on it, then rolls the bedroll and tucks it under his arm like a newspaper. The sweater hangs on his bony shoulders. For a moment, with his bald head held awkwardly, he gazes at the moon, which threads it through the cirrus drifts, and then, as if deciding there's enough light, he starts along the path and begins to climb the hill. We could run, Ellen says. In the dark? It's better than sitting here. There are snakes. We can split up and go for the truck, she says. He can't follow both of us. I check the truck far below us. Who takes the keys? I lift another beer from the cooler, thinking it ironic Ellen is afraid. I'm the one with shadows. I want the cans stacked neatly on the shelves, the books piled carefully on the desk. I keep my dirty clothes in the bathtub and put sugar in the salt shaker. Between 2 and 3 in the afternoon, I order what I need from the supplier in Tucson. The moon spins through the thinning clouds, but the sun's last breath on the horizon gives little light. The man climbs unsteadily, with stick-like strides. His trousers swish, and the bedroll under his arm makes him list to one side. But he doesn't measure his progress against us. Instead, he follows the sounds the deer make skirting the draw. He stops and re-rolls his blanket, then climbs the last few steps to the smooth rock. An unkempt black beard swirls over his jaw. Beneath his heavy eyebrows, his eyes glitter like a coyote's. For a moment, he considers the empty beer cans, the cooler, my boots on the rock. I know this man. He comes from a city where steam rises from manholes and horns split the air, where he sits in cafeterias and draws stares as he walks the streets. Or he comes from the farm belt, the smell of manure acrid where he sleeps. Crops roll by in rows of optical illusions like the crosses of soldiers' graves, and he searches the gravel roads and freeways for aluminum cans. Or he comes from the mountains where snow sifts around the loose panes of his windows and his breath rises in the icy air. He watches the Jeeps and Hummers pass and hears the young men shout. I know he's sunk to the desert at Quito Baquito for water and shade. He sleeps on the ground in his thin bedroll and rises with the dawn. He hunts deer and rabbits and eats the meat of snakes. He's scavenged mesquite, peyote, and the fruits of cactus, and he's endured without the notion of shame. He can harm us. Perhaps he has a knife or a gun in his bedroll, but something beyond my fear makes me pause. He stares at Ellen, who moves behind me into my lee, then at my boots. He lays his bedroll on the ledge, searches among the folds, and pulls out a ragged leather shoe. The sole is rotten and the stitches are torn away from the leather, so the sole flaps open like a slack mouth. The broken laces have been tied and retied into knots. With one eye on us, he measures his worn shoe against the sole of one of my boots. Ellen moves from my shadow. Stop, she says. The man crouches, fingers arced on the stone, and glares. I don't move. The man puts my boots on his bedroll and leaves the leather shoe on the stone. You're going to let him steal, Ellen asks me. He has no knife or gun. I could rush him and knock him from the rock, send him a few feet down the hill, and he would scurry away. But I wait and watch. He pulls the cooler over and rummages through the food. He takes out cheese, ham, hard-boiled eggs, and assembles what he wants on his bedroll. Boots, food, my shirt. Then folds the bedroll like a sack and lifts it to his shoulder. The moon makes him a specter on the edge of the rock. Yet I don't let him go. I hold him with my eyes, knowing when he leaves, he'll leave forever. I dig into my pocket for the key to the truck. Here, I say, holding out the key, take this. Ellen cries out when the headlights of the truck sweep across the dark thicket and turns onto the gravel road toward Lukeville. She screams and clambers down the rocky slope toward the spring. The deer bound away into the darkness. For a while I lie on the warm rock and stare at the stars. We're told the stars move, that in millions of years the constellations will have changed shapes, that new configurations will emerge. I'm comforted only by soaking the warmth of the rock into my body. We choose, and we choose to stay the same until we choose to change. Ellen is miles ahead when I start along the road. The ajos and Puerto Blancos are coal black against the sky. The moon obliterates the stars, and the cold breeze is brittle on my bare skin. I imagine Ellen striding resolutely along the dusty track, not looking back to see whether or not I have followed. I think of her standing naked on the rock, with the wind in her face, offering herself, but taunting me, whether to make me realize what I could have or to show me what I will be without. Miles, hours, my feet ache and blister. I scan the tan gravel for snakes. The moon becomes smaller as it curves past the zenith, but I still make out Ellen's footprints in the roadway. Clouds have dissipated into the colder night air. It's silent around me as I walk, though now and then amid the silhouettes of greasewood and saguaros, I hear the skirmishes of animals in the darkness. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have. That story came to me, as some of my stories do, not all of them by any means, but I was birding in South Arizona, right along the Mexican border in Oregon Pipe, and was camped at the headquarters and drove out by myself to this place called Quito Baquito. I'd never been there before. It's 23 miles of pretty terrible gravel, rough country. I didn't see a single car the whole time I was driving out there. I arrived at this little springs oasis in the desert about noon, which was not a great time to look for birds. And so I got my cooler out of my car, and I made myself a sandwich and opened a beer and sat on my cooler next to the car and was eating a sandwich and reading. And there was nobody around as far as I knew, but then all of a sudden this man walks out of the brush. He was about 50 yards away, and he, you know, I could have gotten my car and bolted, but for some reason I didn't. And he didn't really look threatening, and he wasn't like in a hurry or anything, but he had this weird little blanket under his arm. And he came up to me really close, closer than the chairs. And he stood there for like a minute, which is a really long time. And finally he said, and I'm sitting in my cooler looking at him, and finally he said, "Do you have any spare socks?" And I said, "Yeah." And I took off my shoes and gave him my socks. And he said, "Do you have any spare food?" And I got some stuff out of my cooler. He stuffed all this stuff into his bedroll. And he turned around and walked back into the brush. And that was a really odd thing to do. And I got in my car. I wasn't interested in birds anymore. And drove down the road, and I started crying. I said, "Well, you know, what was this guy doing out there 23 miles from the headquarters, not, in, I don't know, a lot farther from the west, from anywhere?" And I don't know what he was doing out there, but I knew there was some kind of story to be told out of that. And so I took that one little anecdote, which is what I just told you, and made it, you know, added a character, changed the logistics. There are no smooth stones. There's no place they could have ever gone to make love when they're in high school. There's nothing smooth to lie on. I mean, I guess you could have taken a pad or something. But so I just changed enough and tried to create a drama and made this rock farther away so that the man would come in between them and the truck to create some kind of a drama out of it. And that's what happened with the story.
How long did it take you to put that all together? How long ago did this happen?
Oh, it happened a long time ago.
Did you start writing right away?
No, it's a pretty old story, actually. But stories, you know, take different lengths of time. I usually write stories in groups of three. In cycles of three, and I write a draft which takes 2 or 3 weeks, and then I write another draft of a new story, and then another draft of a third story, and 6 weeks have gone by, and then you come back to the first one and you have a little bit of perspective on what you've done in the first one.
And why you do three, so you get
right to you know, so you don't just head back right away to something that's really close to you. And that's worked out pretty well. One time I did 9 stories in a row, and that took like 3 months.
Do you know when you're done with a story?
That's a very hard question to answer. I don't know. I don't know where a story's going when I start, and so it's even tougher for me because I don't have an ending in mind to point toward. I start usually with a character in a place, and then I try to figure out what, I type on a typewriter and I add details, and then I start the page over again. I type the new details in with the old stuff I had, and then I add some more things. And when I figure out the character and what he might do or she might do, I just try to unroll the story as it progresses. So I don't really know. I don't have an ending to aim at. And some stories I don't know that I ever do end. And sometimes I think there's more, and I'm sitting there waiting for 2 days and thinking there's more, but there isn't more. So I just stop. I mean, in fact, one of the stories in here called Hotel Glitter, I love this ending. This is about a woman. It's actually mentioned in the interview on CPR. It's about a woman, a single mother, who lives in Montrose and works in Telluride, and she goes back and forth 60 miles a day or 70 miles a day with a carpool, and comes home to her kid. But she likes this man who she went to school with. And the end of the story, they're driving back to Montrose from Telluride in the dark, and they encounter this herd of elk on the highway. And Rafi, the man, loves elk. He's fascinated by elk. And they drive right into the middle of the herd, which actually I did once coming back from Telluride. And so I know it's possible. And Rafi says, "Now what?" Rafi says, "Now what?" Ava answers. So I don't know, you know, who knows what now. But, you know, I really don't, I try not to wrap up stories in, with a little bow. I like to leave them open-ended so that the reader has to think more about what's happened and where this could go and, you know, feels kind of an emotional involvement in the story so that the story doesn't just end with the last word on the page. That's not a very good answer, is it? Well, definitely that.
So the story is kind of complete as a work.
Or maybe I just don't know anymore, so I have to stop. Anybody else?
Is there, it seems like you added that, the other character for contrast, and just to kind of polarize, meaning added the other character to what actually happened, to polarize you and that character. And is that, that's what it seemed like to me, was that...
You mean the woman character?
Right. Did you?
Yeah, that's definitely true, as far as I can remember.
Like, so in the actual story, you kind of drove away and you cried. You know, I guess there were conflicting emotions there. What was your intention in adding contrast?
Well, I'm trying to create a significant drama that can be played out. I mean, what I told you about after the story was an anecdote. It wasn't really a story. And I try to figure out ways I can make a story out of what happened to me. And so adding a woman helped me do that. I mean, it creates tension between them, and then the tension is heightened when this man appears and they have this dramatic moment where he confronts them. It wasn't, it's not me, it's the character.
I'm sorry.
Right.
The analogous.
Right.
In the
metaphor. Right. Right. I mean, you kind of need three people. Writing one character stories is very difficult because you don't have anything to play against, as you just pointed out. Well, actually, I'm not a teacher. I have taught, but I try not to teach. I'd rather write, and I take semesters because, you know, I don't want a tenured job. I don't want any job. I just want the money that I get from a semester, and then I come back and work some more. I'm always working anyway, even when I'm teaching. But and I have taught quite a bit at Colorado College in the summer, so. I would do the same thing with student stories. I wouldn't do them with my stories. I mean, we would talk about student work in a class. But it would be somewhat the same kind of discussion. I would try not to talk so much. Well, it's where I have taught, yeah. Yes?
So your various breaks in the story, the descriptions of nature, it seemed like there were maybe four or five of those with a certain structure that followed in the story. Did you do that consciously, or was I just hearing it?
No, I don't do much consciously. I wish I could take more credit, but I do think that landscape, a place, is an important element to stories, at least for me. And it's almost another character, because landscape provides a backdrop and mood to all the action that's taking place in the story. And that's true of almost every story in the book. I mean, there's a story set in Alaska, and you try to, you know, give a good, clear... It's not that the reader is going to understand exactly what you see. Yeah, that's not what you hope for, but just enough to feel that the character is real in that circumstance. Well, thank you.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So I heard that you write in a woman's voice often in your books, and I wanted to hear more about how you do that, being a man.
I'm going to get in trouble here. Well, I don't know how you do it. It's a risk, of course. My last novel, which is Land That Moves, Land That Stands Still, was three women on a ranch in South Dakota. They were all three, the main characters were women. I think I recounted on the radio that there was a big event in Vail, and I read from the book there, and somebody way in the back said, how do you do the women so well? And I rephrased the question as, am I a woman? Or are you a woman? And I think I told this story on the radio, too, that I was writing a story years ago, two guys hiking with a woman companion, and it seemed like the same story I'd written several times before. And I thought it would be a lot – I suddenly realized it would be a lot more interesting if the woman were the main character and not the man who is the narrator. And so I changed the narrator to a woman, and the story just became so much better. First of all, women are more interesting. They think more. They have more emotions. They are more complex than men. And so there's a lot of breadth that you can explore with a woman protagonist. And then, I tried that, and it sold that story, and so I've tried some other ones. In this book, I think there's six stories that have a woman's point of view, some of them with an I woman's point of view even. I've had a story in the told from the point of view of a 14-year-old black girl in Selma, Alabama. I mean, that's clearly not who I am. But you can try it, and you may not succeed, but you certainly will learn something. And so I've just experimented with it, and I have some daughters, and I've been married a few times, and I observe.
Would you say this? I've read a couple of those stories and enjoyed them in the book. I haven't heard the interview yet, but would you say that this collection represents a little more somehow of a multicultural or a Southwesterly Latino voice? And, I mean, it just struck me with the place names, with people's histories. Things that I read that might be the case, but
I don't like being labeled just a Western writer, and there are a few stories. There's a story set in North Carolina in here. There's a long story set in South Carolina.
And the Hakim is,
I'm sorry?
Is there one called
Hakim,
or is
it Hakim? Oh, that's Race. That takes place in Uray. But I have a whole book of seven long stories set in Charleston, South Carolina, where I've lived before. And it's fun to explore different places. I don't think I'm confined to the West.
No, but this collection...
It's a smattering of a whole bunch of different stories. And birds are mentioned in almost every story, except maybe there's a story called Who's Danny Pendergast, about a guy who turns into a donkey. That was a hard one to write. I don't think that has birds in it, but there are only two stories that actually have birders as protagonists. The title story is a woman birder who goes to Alaska, and there's another one about a researcher who goes to Costa Rica. But the other stories have birds in them just because I know a lot about birds, and I think birds are a great representation of mystery. And birds, their songs are so different, their habits are so different, their migration is unexplored. Well, it's explored, but it's, people don't really understand how birds know what to do. And so people who know about birds, to me, are interesting people to start with because they have observed something. And you always want your characters to be observant, even if they're not really educated. Yeah, that first story is called Alba. It's about a Hispanic kid who crosses the border and goes to Hatch, New Mexico. And Judy and I have driven through Hatch, New Mexico a bunch of times going birding in Arizona on our way. And I've always just loved Hatch. And it says it's the chili capital of the world. And I don't know why I wanted to set a story there, because I don't really know that much about it just from driving through. But I like the landscape, and so I fiddled around with that and created this kid who says throughout the story, he says he's going to do something great, but he doesn't have any clue what that's going to be or how he's going to do it. And he does do something great by the end of the story, in a way. But I do like exploring different sensibilities. And, you know, things I'm working on now are, they've got another Hispanic narrator. So it's fun to try. I don't know if I'm good at it or not. But.
I like that story quite a bit.
So did The Atlantic.
Some famous writer just fairly recently said that he thought the hardest thing possible, devilishly hard, was to write a short story. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, short stories don't take as much stamina as novels, and that's a good reason to try it. I mean, you can put so much more in, you can just cram a lot of stuff into a novel, but in a story you have to be pretty smart about leaving things out and knowing what's important. And I don't know, I've written lots of stories. I'm almost up to 200 stories now, and it's still fun to do and still... I don't know that it's easy, of course. It's not ever easy, but it's challenging. And I don't know if that's not a very good answer to your question. I'll say yes. How's that?
Can you talk a little bit about the piece that I heard on the radio of the teacher that you had, maybe it was in freshman, who was in college, that really...
Oh, there was a class at Yale called Daily Themes, and in that class you had to write a 300-word short story every day for 8 weeks. And I wasn't an English major. I'd only taken one English course in college. This was my senior year. But I'd always pointed myself toward taking this course because, I don't know, I just wanted to take it. And I've always been interested in writing. I wrote a novel when I was in third grade, 70 pages. But this class it wasn't really taught by one person, so it wasn't like the teacher was inspirational. It was that you had to I spent so much time every single day trying to figure out what to write for 300 words, which is only a page and a half. Something that was, you know, that meant something. It wasn't just ridiculous, silly things like what you did on the weekend or what you did last summer. And I got C minuses and Ds and Fs. I don't know about Fs, but I mean, I just, you know, my grades in that class, I was sure I was going to fail. Not fail, but not do well. And I wrote one, I still remember this one story I wrote about this kid on a motorcycle traveling through Europe, and he's having his lunch and sitting on the motorcycle having his lunch, and stops by an old man who's carving a piece of wood on the sidewalk in Italy. I still remember that. It was a great circumstance, and he has this little conversation with this man, and the kid says, "What are you carving?" And the man says, "I don't know." I've been using that story ever since. I don't know. But what struck me about the course, you know, I mean, I labored over figuring. I mean, I had this long list that I made before the summer before. And after 2 weeks, I'd used everything on my list. And I had 30 stories to write and nothing to say. And I spent hours every day just listening to people talk, asking people questions, reading the newspaper, walking around New Haven, and at, you know, 9 o'clock, I'd write 300 terrible words and turn it in enough to do it again. But it dawned on me, first of all, that you could spend your whole life doing something like this and being curious about people, about different circumstances, and you were also teaching yourself how to do drama just by doing these stories to figure out what makes drama. Nobody was telling you or instructing you, but you'd have to figure it out on your own. And the other thing that struck me was that you had to pay attention, that really this class was training you to look at the world and pay attention to what was out there. And I just love that idea, and I still love that idea, that that's the only thing I hope to get across in a class, is to get my students to pay attention to what's, you know, pay attention to how people talk, pay attention to the weather, pay attention to the climate, you know, whether it's birds or animals or trees, you know, notice those things and have characters notice those things, because you can't write if you don't yourself notice things, which is why birding is so great, because you're always looking for things, paying attention. And you see so much else besides just birds. I noticed when I was reading, I actually had an adverb in that story. Well, my theory is that I want readers to participate as much as I can get them to participate in a story. And any kind of sentences or words, individual words, that instruct readers how to interpret the material, the text, should be taken out. And if you don't put in adverbs, tell readers how to interpret how something is spoken, even if it's "he said softly." The context should tell the reader that the voice would not be raised in that circumstance. And the reader has to supply that information or that interpretation to the story, which is why I think adverbs are dangerous to use. I mean, you can't ever avoid 100% of the adverbs, but...
Really
dangerous? Very dangerous. They are dangerous. See, I don't need that adverb.
I guess by now it's probably habit for you to remove them. But where did this fixation on adverbs come from?
Oh, I have lots of fixations.
Just tell us about your fixation on that.
Oh.
Well, again, to go back and finish the question about adverbs, the point of not putting in adverbs is to make the reader more involved. That's also the point of leaving out certain material, but also the point of putting in enough, like, say, place details that the reader can feel he's there or she's there and can believe that the character is acting in a real world, even though it's a fictional world. And so whenever the writer instructs the reader how to interpret something, I think that should come out of my story. And, you know, I still do it. And I try to catch it by the fifth draft or something. What was I going to say next?
Bats.
What?
Bats. She wanted to know about your...
Oh, that. That is a function word. And it, you know, if you take the sentence, "I saw that he derived," why do you need to put that in there? And another word that drives me crazy is "just." And "just" has only come into the language in the last 15 years. And everybody speaks with the word "just." "I just went to the store." But you don't have to write that word in your manuscripts. But I see in almost... Okay. In Jonathan Franzen's last novel, there were 1,168 uses of "that" and 682 uses of "just" that he could have just taken out. You want to know how I know that, don't you? I now read. When I read, I have a pen and I circle them. And then I add them up at the end. What?
Don't adjectives drive you crazy?
Well, adjectives have their use, but you don't need 14 in a paragraph. I mean, I could point you to a published novel that has 15 participles on one page, too, which is kind of scary. Because, I mean, clearly the writer and clearly Jonathan Franzen has no clue that they're doing that, or otherwise they wouldn't do it. But that's, you know, you don't have to print that in any magazine. Those are just my own pet peeves, and I have a few of them.
What's another one?
That's an adverb. But yes, you can figure out a synonym. It's just the repetition. It's not wrong to use those words. It's not wrong. It's just not necessary. And then when they get repeated, then the readers should pay attention. I don't understand why copy editors who publish these novels don't catch those things themselves. I mean, you know, things like putting "well" into dialogue. I mean, people say, "Well, I just don't know what to do." But if you write that 20 times in a novel, that's too many. I mean, everybody says it, yes, but you're not trying to duplicate human speech. You're trying to create a dramatic discourse. I mean, if you tried to duplicate human speech, it'd be full of ums and ers and all sorts of weird things that don't need to be there. But that's just the surface of things. Other questions? Well, thanks a lot for being here. I appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodin. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.